From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Small businesses often complain about problems created by government regulation. But a UNC history professor reminds us that this attitude toward government is a relatively recent development. State lawmakers decided to scrap proposed captions for constitutional amendments on the November ballot. You'll learn why. Speaking of those amendments, you'll learn why two of them have generated united opposition from all five living former North Carolina governors, Democrat and Republican. And we'll recap the current governor's recent tour of communities hit hard by Hurricane Matthew. You'll learn what some of the people living in those communities had to say to Governor Roy Cooper. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Are the Russians meddling in U.S. and world energy markets? Well, despite credible bipartisan concerns, we really don't know for sure, and we need to. That is the conclusion of a piece written at thehill.com by John Locke Foundation Senior Fellow Don Vandervaart. Don used to be the Secretary of North Carolina's Department of Environmental Quality before he joined the John Locke Foundation. In this piece written for The Hill, he details the instances that lead to serious questions about Russian collusion. He also has some recommendations for the Trump administration as well. Don, welcome to Carolina Journal Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So how and why are the Russians meddling in energy markets?
Well, the first thing we have to recognize is that natural gas is an extremely important commodity for Russia. More than 50% of their export revenues come from natural gas. So anytime the natural gas supplies change, Russia's interested. And of course, North America has experienced a revolution in natural gas production over the last 10 years.
Fracking.
Due to hydraulic fracturing. Mm-hmm. And that has significantly increased the supply of natural gas. And some of this is being considered for export to the same markets that Russia is selling their natural gas into, namely Europe, Eastern Europe.
It sounds as if you're describing competitive pressures and the Russians are taking notice.
That's exactly right. And what is remarkable is not that Russia is concerned about competitors. Anybody in business has those feelings. What is remarkable is that Russia is using, apparently, according to Hillary Clinton and others, environmental groups to try to dissuade North America's hydraulic fracturing efforts.
How so?
Well, there are a number of different instances where protesters have been apparently funded by Russian groups to show up at meetings that where the expansion of hydraulic fracturing is being discussed. One instance when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she was speaking at an energy event where she also referred to phony, those are her terms, phony environmental groups that are protesting for pay, whether it's, as she said, fracking or pipelines. At the time, the XL pipeline was still being held up. This is a concern at two levels. First of all, we have Russians apparently who are funding protests that affect our energy policy. Our Americans' energy policy is something that can be debated, but when we have undue influence funded by not our favorite nations, we should be concerned and recognize that. The other issue, which is the one that I'm most concerned about, well, I'm also concerned about, is the fact that the use of these environmental groups will cheapen and corrupt, in the eyes of Americans, the value of these groups.
And in fact, that very notion there is one of the reasons that you make a recommendation to the Trump administration to look into this. And it's curious because I'm sure our listeners know, unless you've been living in a cave for the last year and a half, there's been all sorts of media coverage, speculation, some facts and data coming out about whether or not Russia was involved some way, and it looks like the intelligence is saying they were doing things on the web, et cetera, involving the 2016 presidential election. Yet your point in this column that you wrote for The Hill is that why isn't anyone similarly concerned about potential meddling, collusion, whatever you want to call it, in our energy markets?
That's exactly right. Nobody likes the idea of folks meddling, foreign entities not friendly to us, meddling in our elections. But they should be very concerned about the meddling in our energy policy. And again, from an environmental standpoint, when I see the possibility that one or more of special interest environmental groups that we have all looked to and trusted may be being corrupted by serving as a proxy for the Russians in this meddling, then I want to clear the air. I want to make sure that that we know who they are and we know who they aren't, so that going forward we can continue to rely on those that have resisted or have not taken part in this sort of corrupt sort of activity.
You mentioned the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and her comments about this, but you also detail in your piece that a key official at NATO has made comments about this, expressing concerns. Also, there's a House committee report that gets to this issue. Do environmental groups understand, or have they discussed, that there might be some compromising things going on here with their message?
This is my question. Where are the environmental groups on the question of taking money from Russians? One of the reports that is cited in the paper details money going through a offshore account back into some environmental groups here in America. That may be innocent enough, but at the same time, since it's Russian money, and since we have Hillary Clinton claiming that Russians were funding some environmental groups, I'd like to know who is who. And by doing that, we find out what influence Russia really is having in our energy policy discussions.
One would think that the environmental groups, who have spent decades really building their credibility, their reputation, would be concerned, and that they would want the air to be cleared, as you put it.
Well, that's a great point. If I were working for EDF or NRDC, and I'm just naming a few, this would be very troublesome to me because, as I point out, there have been reports on this. This was reported in the New York Times and Newsweek, elsewhere. If I were a member of the public who was aware of this possibility, I'm just left to speculating who is being corrupted and who isn't. And so if I were, as I said, one of these environmental groups, I'd want to clear the air as well.
What should happen now?
Well, frankly, if there's not the kind of reporting that you refer to in the as is going on in the elections meddling situation, I would want the Trump administration, maybe an interagency effort, to look into it, and it would also be in response to the concern shown by some of the representatives that wrote letters that I referred to.
Now, you mentioned that there is a House report that referred to some of this. Does that mean that there are members of Congress who might be willing to perhaps push for some sort of investigatory body or effort?
I would think so. Lamar Smith from Texas is one who wrote a letter and who participated in the study. I would think he'd be very interested to know what's going on.
Ultimately, Don, what's at stake here when we talk about the U.S. and the world energy market?
Two things. One is perhaps a corrupted influence on our energy policy as it proceeds. And the other is a loss of credibility of some of the very groups that have helped establish new environmental policies going forward.
It's a fascinating piece written by our guest, Don Vandervaart. He is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. Don, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Ask a small business owner today about the biggest obstacles he faces, and you might hear him talk about government rules and regulations. But that hasn't always been the case for those running small businesses. Our next guest says, in the past, not even the really distant past, many small business owners saw government as an ally. Dr. Benjamin Waterhouse is Associate Professor of History at UNC Chapel Hill. He is author of The Land of Enterprise, A Business History of the United States, and Lobbying America, The Politics of Business from Nixon to NAFTA. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
So you recently spoke to the John Locke Foundation Shaftesbury Society about small business and American politics in the 20th century, and you titled the lecture, The Populist Paradox. Why so?
Well, the talk I gave springs from a research project I'm doing about the history of small business and particularly its role in American politics, culture, and life in the 20th century, and particularly in the late 20th century. And the paradox that I am sort of pointing to is that in today's political environment, really the political environment that we've seen for the last several decades, the general position of small business owners, as you said, has been sort of an anti-government, anti-regulatory, anti-tax position. Whether or not that applies to every small business is certainly something we could debate, but certainly the loudest voices and mouthpieces of the small business community have aligned themselves with that set of politics, and it's frequently couched in a somewhat populist language of the little guy versus the big guy. Now, classically across American history, that dynamic, that small versus big, has often operated within the business community or within sort of the capitalist structure as an opposition toward entrenched economic power or the size of large companies. And so the talk I gave really kind of looked back at the origins of small business identity and focused on the fact that in the early days of sort of small business identity, that is to say in the early days of when there was big business, small businesses saw themselves primarily in competition with large corporate interests, large monopolies, and so forth. And they turn to the government through tax policy, through antitrust policy, and other types of government policies to redress the kind of imbalances or the competitive challenges they faced. And in fact, when they saw themselves politically, they typically aligned against big business and saw themselves allied with the government. And the paradox I identify is what happens by the late 20th century when that seems to go away. We retain the populist language, that sort of sense of the little versus the big, but the big has now shifted from being big business to being big government.
That is Dr. Benjamin Waterhouse, Associate Professor of History at UNC Chapel Hill. So those who see government and small businesses as natural antagonists ought to look back at the history a little bit and see that this hasn't always been the case.
Well, particularly, yeah, I think that's right. And when the question comes to, you know, how do you maintain a small economic enterprise in a environment of free competition? And the irony or the challenge is that the conditions of free competition frequently allow those who outcompete to grow, to expand, and to then use the power they create to continue to grow and expand. And so, in fact, this sort of free competition creates the environment in which it can extinguish itself. And, you know, if the concern is to kind of perpetuate the small, the local, and the sort of more personal things that we associate with small business, in the past, particularly in the early part of the 20th century and really through the 1930s or so, the focus was on using the law, on using the power of the state to restrict size, restrict mergers and acquisitions and integration at the largest levels, and to actively promote those small businesses.
Do you have a sense at this point in your research about why there's been such a major change?
Well, I think on a political level, the economic crisis years of the sort of last third of the 20th century are key. You know, as of the 1970s, the rapid growth, economic growth that we experienced in the post-World War II years came to a halt. This is the period of inflation, economic stagnation, energy crisis, and so forth, where the sort of expectations of rising tides lifting all boats seemed to come up short. And this coincides with a particular movement really spearheaded by elite and successful economic interests, big businesses, to sort of limit or to try to push back against anything that was perceived to be limiting their economic growth. So the general business response to the end of the growth economy was to redirect their policy attention against regulation, labor unions, and tax policy and things like that. That, on a certain level, attracted many small business owners. And as I said, it's particularly the people who speak on behalf of the small business community as opposed to everyone who owns a small business. But a lot of the organizing around small business that blossoms in the 1970s and 1980s, organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which sort of always seemed to be on the side of Main Street, but they had really in the mid-20th century been a big business-oriented group, they start to turn their focus. The National Federation of Independent Business was created in the 1940s as a fairly localized, you know, survey-oriented group. They become extremely active in political lobbying by the 1980s, and they all sort of coalesce around a common economically conservative view of policy that dovetails very well with the interests of the larger firms as well.
Does any of the change from your vantage point have to do with the way government has changed?
I think that's a part of it. You know, as I said, the big debate among historians of the 20th century is really what the prime movers are. One way to tell the story is that the state itself grew in its reach, in its focus, in the types of agenda, the types of positions it was trying to promote from the Progressive period through the New Deal period and then through the 1960s. And that much of what we've seen since then has been a sort of a pushback against those types of economic policies. I think a complementary way to kind of conceive of the 20th century does really have to do with the challenges of economic growth since the early 1970s and the broad sort of stagnation or slowdown in productivity increases and so forth. And so as a result, you know, those whichever one of those stories we want to kind of adhere to, you do have a different role for the government, particularly the federal government, in economic life.
In the remaining time that we have, this is all interesting historically. I think some people listening to us will say, so what does this mean for the future? What's going to be the attitude of business, especially small business, toward government in the future?
Well, I think this is the open question. It is still the case, and in fact, I think it's been consistently the case for the last 30 years, that large economic institutions, large corporations continue to grow. They continue to exercise greater competitive advantage over small outfits, and we see this in a variety of spaces, from, you know, retail and bookselling to tech to certainly the old classical kind of titans of the old industrial economy, from automotive to resource extraction, petroleum, oil, and things like that. It doesn't seem to me that there's much chance of of a turnaround. You know, it seems that that's sort of the direction that things are going. The small local mom and pop type stores are, you know, under a lot of pressure. And they're under a lot of strain.
That is the voice of Dr. Benjamin Waterhouse, Associate Professor of History at UNC Chapel Hill. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. When North Carolina voters head to the polls in November, they'll see six items labeled simply as constitutional amendment. Lawmakers voted for that generic label rather than give a three-member commission the task of developing captions for the amendments.
No matter who's in charge down here, you don't want an outside group doing your job for you. We don't. For all the past years, the body in control have written their own amendments. This is a constitutional prerogative that you have. We don't need any other group other than this very body here and the one across the hall over there to write amendments. We don't need captions written. We don't need that, folks. And we don't want that. We want to do our job, and our job is to write the question out on the constitutional amendment and give the public a chance to vote yes or no. That's simply what we're doing, is restoring common sense.
That's Republican Senator Jerry Tillman. Democrat Floyd McKissick disagreed.
I think we should be very honest, candid, sincere with each other. If the makeup of this commission had two Republicans and one Democrat, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be debating this. If perhaps Buck Newton had become Attorney General, and we still had Paul Coble here, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be debating it. This is all political, just like all six of the amendments. They're driven specifically to help bring out the Republican base. And I think it really is trying to disguise things in a way that assumes that either members of this chamber are naive or that the public is naive to suggest otherwise.
Senate Republican leader Harry Brown responded.
That three-person panel had never gotten political until here recently. And if you want to talk about politics being thrown into something, never before do we have to worry about this issue. And you want to talk about who started the political side of this issue, it was that three-person panel that we're talking about when they started leaking out how they wanted to change the wording on the ballot for these constitutional amendments. Different than what we passed as legislators. Now, who's political in this process? I'd say they are. And that's what caused us to come back today and have to do what we're doing today. And that's unfortunate because it was never intended for that to happen, and it hadn't happened that I'm aware of before. I think the public is smart, and I think the public can read these amendments and make their own decisions. And I think that's important, that the people of this state get to choose if they like these amendments or not. And I don't know how you can be any fairer to the public than have the people decide. If they don't like the amendments, they can vote no.
You've been listening to debate about labels for six constitutional amendments on the ballot in North Carolina this fall. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock. Just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Every living North Carolina governor opposes two proposed state constitutional amendments. One would change the way the state fills judicial vacancies. The other would change rules for appointments to state boards. The governors say both amendments would take power away from the governor's office. Republican Jim Martin recently joined the other living former governors for a news conference in the state capitol.
Why are we here? Well, it's not to celebrate our longevity. We're here for a higher purpose, to do our part to protect the constitutional authority and integrity of the office of Governor of North Carolina, the state's chief executive, who alone is charged by the North Carolina Constitution to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Our General Assembly has chosen to submit to the voters two proposed constitutional amendments that we believe would seriously undermine the governor's ability to carry out that fundamental responsibility. One of these amendments would take from the governor to the legislature all authority to appoint thousands of individuals to hundreds of boards and commissions that have vital administrative responsibilities. The second amendment would impair the governor's ability to appoint judges to fill vacancies on our courts by restricting his or her choice to only two, and those two would be selected by a partisan vote of the General Assembly. How's that for separation of powers? You see, this fundamental and revered civic protection spelled out by the founders in both the national and state constitutions is also under assault.
Democrat Jim Hunt weighed in on the amendments.
This effort that we oppose on a strong bipartisan basis is against a few politicians in the legislature, increasing their power at the expense of the people of the state of North Carolina. It is a bad thing for the people of North Carolina. When people vote for the governor, all of them, they decide on their future. They all get to vote for the governor. It's easy to talk about all these terms and all these ideas, and they're fine. But it's really about whether or not a few politicians in the legislature will increase their power at the expense of the people of North Carolina.
You're listening to former North Carolina governors speaking against two proposed constitutional amendments. Democrat Mike Easley noted the former governor's bipartisan agreement.
Never have five of us gotten together and stuck it to you on the same issue. And so you can believe we believe in what we're saying to you today. The checks and balances are so critical, as our founding fathers pointed out and made certain that we followed throughout history. So we did in North Carolina. I think it's important to understand that the power of the executive is in those boards and those commissions. And you can't do your job as governor if you don't have access to those commissions and those boards. And they respond to who appoints them. My concern, overriding concern in all of this, is not about the governor or the legislature or the judiciary or any other office holder. Our overriding concern is about the people of North Carolina. And if these amendments were to pass, there would be one lawsuit after the other, and it would go on for a long time. The state would be paralyzed. You would not have people confirmed for boards. You would not have people confirmed for commissions. As soon as one person was nominated and confirmed, the other person would file a lawsuit and would get tied up in the courts ad infinitum. Those who suffer are not the office holders. Those who suffer are the people.
Democrat Bev Perdue reminded listeners that the issue revolves around more than just who controls government.
All of this that gets done in Raleigh or anywhere in the country is not about power. It's not about being governor or being head of the Supreme Court or being the speaker or the pro tem. It's about the people. Everything that goes on here should be open, transparent, and it should be about the people of North Carolina. Does it make our lives, now that I'm a regular citizen, any better? Does it help my family, my children, my community? Or is it all about making me boss hog? I think boss hogs scare me. I don't know about you. These amendments don't do anything at all. It's not partisan. Look at the five of us. We've never been united like we are on an issue because we care about the state. Now, I'm not saying the legislature doesn't care about the people of North Carolina. But I am saying, from my perspective as one citizen, it appears to me they care a whole lot more about who has the power and who can do whatever needs to be done to control that power and to consolidate that power.
Republican Pat McCrory explained why he returned to the old State House chamber where he took his initial oath of office.
I returned to this chamber to continue to protect the Constitution of the United States and of North Carolina that I was sworn to uphold right here. This is not my first battle. While governor, I regretfully had to take our legislature all the way to the North Carolina Supreme Court to fight another attempt to strip our executive branch of its rightful duties and responsibilities. With the help of Governors Hunt and Governor Martin, McCrory versus Berger, the court, in near unanimous decision, ruled to protect this governor and future governors from legislative overreach. Now that I'm out of office, I'm proud to join these other governors in continuing this fight. My advice to the hardworking legislators, if any of you want to take on the responsibilities of the governor, then have the courage to run for governor and win. Earn it. Don't hijack our Constitution especially through two deceitful and misleading amendments that will be on the ballot.
The Republican Martin distinguished the governor's message from partisan bickering.
It would be a mistake to say this is a partisan fight between Republicans and Democrats. It's worse. It's legislators versus governors. You see the five of us here before you, every living former governor, Democrats and Republicans, together on this opposition. This Republican majority today not only has tried to seize executive authority from a Democrat, but just a few years ago, you may remember, they were doing the same to a fellow Republican. Before that, we had Democrats in the majority of both legislative bodies, and guess what? They not only tried to stop this Republican and Governor Holzhauser before any of us to strip us of key appointments, they did the same when our governor was a Democrat. You see, this is not about partisan politics. It's about power politics, and it must be stopped.
That's Jim Martin, one of five former North Carolina governors, Republican and Democrat, speaking out against two proposed constitutional amendments. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. In October of 2016, Hurricane Matthew wreaked havoc on eastern North Carolina. And yet, nearly 2 years later, questions swirl around the state government's response when it comes to restoring the homes and the lives of those folks who were affected. Now, in early August, Governor Roy Cooper traveled to the impacted area. Carolina Journal Associate Editor Lindsay Marcello was on that trip, and she joins us now. Lindsay, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Remind us of when and where it hit and what the overall impact was.
So this storm hit nearly 2 years ago in October in eastern Carolina. It was hit in Birdie County and Columbus County, Robinson and Cumberland. It dealt a significant amount of damage. I think North Carolina Emergency Management estimated that there was at least $4.8 billion in damages done to property.
Incredible. And there were some people killed in this situation.
Yes, at least 31 people. Lives were lost.
You talked to one of the victims of Hurricane Matthew when you accompanied the governor on this trip. Tell us about that conversation.
So I met with a man named Benjamin Phillips. He lives in Lumberton, and he's lived in his house for like over 40 years. And he was heavily impacted by the storm. He lost the roof of his house was damaged. The carpets were all soaked. The wallpaper was peeling down. And it's been nearly 2 years, and it's only now starting to get repaired. Through the community development block grants. Robinson County is the first county to actually be able to access these grants because they've completed their environmental impact study. Several other counties have yet to be able to access these because they haven't finished their environmental study or they're still waiting for the federal government to approve them.
Now, Lindsay, what you just said may surprise some of our listeners because I think an average person would say, hey, wait a second, it's been almost 2 years, and what have people been doing? Where have they been living? What's happened to their lives over those 2 years?
A lot of people have either been moved in with family, they've gone to hotels, they've lived in FEMA trailers. They've not been able to live in their houses because of mold, mildew, lack of power, etc. There has been aid delivered to these counties, but it's not enough to impact that $4.8 billion. You have millions in state and federal funds. I think North Carolina Emergency Management estimates that there's over $700 million on the ground right now, but there's still $236 million wrapped up behind bureaucratic red tape with the community development block grants.
That is just stunning to hear that. It sounds to me like from your reports, the issue is not a lack of federal or state recovery funding. Mm-hmm. It's just trying to get it to people.
Yeah, the money is there. It's just that it's locked up behind all these eight-step process that people have to do. They have to make multiple trips to application centers, and they can't even do that until an environmental impact study is done. And these studies take a long time, and then you have to wait for the housing and urban development agency, the federal government, to approve those. And if they don't approve it, you have to do it again, and then it just sets the clock back.
Boy, for those of us who are interested in efficient, limited government, that's the classic nightmare of what happens. What does Governor Cooper say about all this?
He says, you know, to be patient, we're working hard, we're going to get the money out to you, but he can't give us a timeline for when those monies are going to be released. For instance, Columbus County was one of the hardest hit counties. In it, Fairbluff is a small town. Most of its stores are still boarded up, and they have yet to see anything from the community development block grants.
Lindsay, is there something different about the process to get funding from the feds or from the state actually to the people who need it? Is there something different this time around? Because I'm trying to recall any type of delay like this when previous disasters have hit.
Yes, this program was originally implemented by the Department of Commerce. But I think prior to Hurricane Matthew, and I think it was in 2016, the General Assembly transferred that to the North Carolina Emergency Management, which said that they could implement this program. Part of the problem, though, is that HUD only deals with the Department of Commerce. They wouldn't deal with North Carolina Emergency Management until they reworked and remade the program from the ground up. So a lot of that, like reworking, that's taken a lot of time to get done. So that set a lot of the delays.
What about the General Assembly then? If part of this is, as you described, with a change in procedure, what do we hear from state legislators about what's happening here?
They're frustrated. They want to see these funds getting released sooner. They want to see people getting help sooner. They passed the Disaster Relief Act soon after the disaster, and they were able to get, I don't remember the exact number, but it was in the millions of money out to these communities that were impacted, but it's still just not enough. So they set up the House Select Committee on Disaster Relief, and they've been looking into how do we streamline this process so that it's more efficient and it gets people faster while still balancing accountability and making sure that there's no fraud in this disaster relief.
Any progress in that area? Have they come up with any ideas that everyone can agree upon? In the meantime, of course, there are people who are waiting.
Right. I think they have reestablished the committee after the short session. Speaker Tim Moore, he came back and said, okay, we need to keep looking at this, so we'll reinstate the committee to, you know, figure out what we can do. But I think they're at a loss of how do you speed up this process when the steps, the eight-step program, that's set by the federal government. So that change needs to come from higher up, too. So this is not something that only we can do, but that the federal government needs to help us with, too.
Do we know if the governor's office, for example, has contacted the Trump administration to say, hey, we've got a real problem down here in North Carolina?
He has asked for funding and has asked more funding, but that doesn't seem to be the problem, is the access to funding. It's just being able to get that money out to the communities. So I'm not aware of whether or not Cooper has come out and said, hey, this program is taking too long. It is too hard for people to finish in a timely fashion. So I'm not aware of whether or not he has come out to say that.
What are the locals saying about all this? Because they're living right in the middle of it. For them, it is a daily story. It's not just something that gets reported on now and then.
They're frustrated. They're trying to be patient, but it's hard to be patient when your house was basically destroyed. They've been able to turn to the local communities, to nonprofits, to other financial sources for disaster relief. There's small business association loans. There's the hazard mitigation grants that I believe that's administered by FEMA. But part of the problem, again, is that sometimes people are not able to be qualified for those programs and they're shut out and they don't know what they can do. So Cooper, at least, he has said that, you know, people need to call the number 211 to see what kind of funding that they are eligible for.
What was the interaction like between Governor Cooper and the folks that he was meeting with?
They seemed happy, I mean, for him to be out there. It's probably a great thing for them to be able to see him face-to-face and be able to talk to him. I think it would be beneficial if he, you know, did this more often, went down and talked to people face-to-face, and, you know, so they're not dealing with, like, this faceless bureaucratic government. But once again, they're tired. They're waiting for relief, and it's just been a long time coming.
Now, you were there talking to some of the folks affected. You mentioned Benjamin Phillips had mentioned to you and his situation. Help us understand a little bit more about what you saw.
So with his house, I mean, the roof had been destroyed. He recently had it reshingled using that community development block grant funding. His carpet is still nasty, for lack of a better word. Wow. I have asthma. I would not be able to live in that house. It's too musty and mildewy. But he's been staying in there and holding out. But there still needs to be a lot of work done. Wallpaper needs to be repaired.
Sounds like he's an example of what's happening in that community
as they wait for
the funds. And bottom line on your story seems to be the funding is there. It's just the bureaucratic process that is delaying getting it to the people who really need it. Lindsay, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.